The sentence is in for South Korea's former president. Yoon Suk-yeol gets life in prison for an attempted insurrection in 2024.
What he was telling me was that he wanted Yoon to get the death penalty.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, the Epstein files lead to a major arrest in the UK, a now disgraced prince.
Andrew has been a huge source of embarrassment for the British royal family.
And what thousands of Chinese fishing boats are doing in the East China Sea.
They can essentially cut off Taiwan by total control around these important waterways.
Plus, all that glitters at Rio's carnival is a massive environmental hazard.
We're dealing with glitter and other microplastics that have been in the oceans for years and years and years.
All those stories and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in. A couple of big developments overnight. In South Korea, a judge has handed down a sentence for the country's former president. He was charged with treason, among other things. That story's coming up. But first, in a development that's gripping the British public, not to mention the rest of the globe, a former prince and brother to the King of England was arrested today. Law enforcement officers showed up at the home of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, formerly Prince Andrew, the Duke of York, and took him into custody. The disgraced British royal was arrested following the latest release of the Epstein files. In a statement, the local police say that Windsor is now back at his home after 12 hours of questioning, but he remains under investigation. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has been following this.
The arrest took place at his home, Sandringham Estate, in Norfolk early this morning. It leaked very quickly, by the way, because photographers were already staked out at the property. The police have given us very little details. They've said so far that Andrew has been arrested, not charged, for what they call misconduct in public office. Under British law, there's a lot that can't be said because of a potential criminal trial. But we do know the arrest is in relation to his position as a trade envoy to Britain and documents he may have released to Jeffrey Epstein. We do understand that UK police are looking into allegations of trafficking of young women to the UK by Epstein for alleged sexual encounters with Andrew, but that's not what today's arrest is about.
Yes, so do we have any other information about these specific offences, about that stated misconduct that he is alleged to have committed as trade envoy?
Well, we know from the latest Epstein file release that he appears to have forwarded his itinerary for trade visits to Southeast Asia, for example. It seems that he allegedly forwarded government reports from visits to Vietnam, Singapore and China to Epstein. There were some reports this week that he allegedly leaked sensitive information about the Royal Bank of Scotland to Epstein. Now, what Epstein did with that information, we don't yet know. Andrew was a trade envoy for 10 years up until 2011, and with that role you're bound under the UK's Official Secrets Act. The question is whether he breached that act. I was talking to a former chief crown prosecutor in England a little bit earlier, and he was saying a potential sentence for misconduct in public office can be as much as life in prison. And the police would have thought long and hard about making this arrest this morning because they know how it would have reverberated not only across England, but around the world. But this former chief crown prosecutor, Nazir Afzal, also made the point, you know, the police moved very fast on this case when it was a case that seemed to involve state secrets. Mm. Not so much when it came to allegations involving young women.
When the allegation involves the state potentially being a victim, the state here moves very rightly at pace. When the allegation involves a woman being a victim, the state has been very slow to act. There have been at least a decade's worth of questions being asked in relation to Andrew and Epstein and, you know, alleged victims coming forward, and no progress has been made in relation to that.
I should say the family of Virginia Giuffre did welcome the news of Andrew's arrest earlier. Giuffre, you remember, she alleged that she was trafficked by Epstein and forced to have sex with Andrew on three occasions, twice when she was 17, under the legal age of consent. She went on to take her own life last year, but her family issued a statement today saying, "We extend our gratitude to UK police and for their investigation and the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. He was never a prince," they said, "and for survivors everywhere, Virginia, this is for you."
Interesting. So law enforcement officials are not just reacting to revelations in the Epstein files in the UK, but also across Europe. What are some of the investigations that have been launched elsewhere, Orla?
Yeah, correct. And I should say within the UK, police are also investigating Peter Mandelson, remember, the former UK ambassador to the US. That case, no charges have been made. But interestingly, that's also caused a lot of problems for the UK government. Also, as you said, senior politicians are being held to account elsewhere. The former Prime Minister of Norway was charged late last week with gross corruption in connection with his ties to Epstein. Also, the Norwegian ambassador to Jordan and Iraq, she resigned from her position in the last couple of weeks because of disclosures of financial dealings between her and her husband and Epstein. In France, the offices of the Arab World Institute in Paris, this prestigious institute, were searched by police earlier this week because its president, Jack Lang, who's the former culture minister in France, is also mentioned in the files and he's being investigated. We have Slovakia's national security advisor has stepped down, and then there are investigations being launched in Lithuania and Latvia into whether young citizens from those countries were trafficked by Jeffrey Epstein. There's a lot of movement. It will continue. We're still hearing more and more over the last few days. We're going to hear more in the coming weeks, but it does appear to be a very different reaction from what we've seen in the US.
Yeah, pretty stunning all around, though. I mean, these elites, one by one, under the microscope. Back to Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor and his arrest today, Orla. How damaging is all this for the royal family?
It's very damaging. I mean, Andrew has been a huge source of embarrassment for the British royal family. Today, King Charles came out with a statement saying the police have our full and wholehearted support and cooperation. He said the law must take its course. He was meeting with ambassadors of Spain and El Salvador and Kenya this morning, and I'm sure he was kind of relieved to have that distraction, but he was out on the streets of London this afternoon attending the opening of London Fashion Week. And have a listen to the reaction as he stepped out of the car.
What's your reaction to your brother's arrest, sir? Sir, what's your reaction to your brother's arrest? Any reaction to your brother's arrest, sir?
He didn't respond to reporters. He waved at some members of the public who had gathered nearby, but he went about his way. He has distanced himself from Andrew, his younger brother, for some time. He stripped Andrew of his royal titles last year. He evicted Andrew from the Royal Lodge in Windsor, and that was only earlier this month. Presumably, they maybe had a hint of what was coming out in the files. So he's done a lot to try and separate the rest of the royal family from Andrew, but it's no doubt that it is an embarrassment. The last time a member of the royal family was arrested was 1647 during the English Civil War.
Wow.
King Charles, yeah. He was ultimately convicted of high treason and executed, Marco. That was the ending for him.
The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
In South Korea, a court has sentenced former President Yoon Suk-yeol to life in prison for attempting to launch an insurrection in 2024. The conservative leader had, at the time, declared martial law and sent military forces to the National Assembly. His decree lasted only about 6 hours, soon after Yoon was impeached and arrested. Reporter Jason Strother was outside the courthouse in Seoul today when the verdict was handed down. When we spoke earlier, he described the scene.
So when I arrived, it was kind of a ruckus scene. The streets were lined with Yoon's supporters. They were held back from getting too close to the courthouse by a phalanx of riot police. In the past, his supporters, when they got some bad news, ransacked a courthouse. So some precautions were taken. But things quieted down as soon as the judge began speaking. It was broadcast over loudspeakers and on national television. The pro-Yoon demonstrators administrators listened very closely to every word the judge was saying. And about an hour into that delivery, the judge reached the part where he handed down the life behind bar sentence to Yoon, and the mood got sour very quick on the streets of Seoul. But even though, I should say, even though Yoon's supporters were in full force today on the streets outside the courthouse, they do not represent the overall mood in South Korea. Many people here, according to polls and surveys, support Yoon's imprisonment, and that's according to Joon-ha Park, who is a correspondent with Korea Risk Group. I gave him a call after the verdict was handed down.
There are sort of sensible figures to suggest that the South Korean public still fall in line with the fact that martial law was a wrong thing, that the former president was not right in making that decision on December 3rd, and his follow-through and also his attitude within trials was not something that aligned with basic social norms.
Important context there, and what an intense scene. I have to imagine that part of all that was the anticipation that Yoon might be facing the death penalty. Do we know why he received a life sentence instead?
Right. There were pretty much only two possible sentences that Yoon could have received. One was life behind bars or the death penalty. Now, Judge Ji gave a few reasons why he went with the former option, life in prison. One, Yoon is 65 years old. The other is that Yoon has been a lifelong public servant. He was a prosecutor. And also that his martial law declaration was rather short-lived, only several hours, and it was bloodless. So Judge Ji opted for life behind bars instead.
And how have those rationales gone down with the general public, given the charge of insurrection?
You know, it was hard to find anti-Yoon demonstrators on the street today, Marco. But I did find a small group of them kind of taking shelter away from all the Yoon supporters. They were being protected by the police as well. One gentleman who I spoke to, a man in his 40s who just asked to go by Mr. Hwang, says he was disappointed. What he was telling me was that he wanted Yoon to get the death penalty.
What does it tell us that a lot of people are still supporting this man who pushed for insurrection?
He has diehard supporters, and they don't seem to be giving up anytime soon on their support for him. I spoke with a handful of his supporters who came out today to the courthouse. One woman who I spoke with, she was 59 and asked just to go by her surname Hong, said that she expected this outcome. But still, it's unbelievable. She says that she has lost faith in the court system, that the court was out of control. And despite the verdict, she's going to continue to support Yoon and protest for him. One other thing about Ms. Hong that I found interesting was that she was carrying two flags with her. One was the Korean flag and the other was the American flag. So I asked her why she had the stars and stripes in her hand. And she said, just like the Stop the Steal movement in the U.S., many of Yoon's supporters believe that North Korea and China are somehow interfering in South Korea's elections.
Wow. Is there any legitimacy to these ideas that China and North Korea were somehow part of this?
So far, the Conservative Party has not been able to provide any evidence that North Korea or China was involved with the election. There has been a very strong anti-China movement that has come up in the wake of Yoon's arrest and imprisonment. It's gotten a little ugly.
Jason, what are the next steps for former President Yoon?
Yoon has 7 days to appeal today's verdict, but he also has another trial on the horizon. And this case centers around allegations that he ordered drones to be flown into North Korean airspace in hopes of provoking Pyongyang to attack South Korea and give justification for his martial law decree.
Jason Strother reporting from Seoul. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
An unusual and large formation of what appear to be fishing boats, and what that tells us about China. That conversation is coming up. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In recent months, analysts have noticed something odd happening out in the East China Sea. If you were to look at recent satellite images of that body of water between mainland China and Japan, you would see a reverse L shape, two perfectly straight lines that are made up of thousands of Chinese fishing boats. The longer line of that shape is 300 miles of vessels running along a north-south axis, smack dab between China's and Japan's economic zones.
Thousands of boats that basically are forming a physical block in the middle of a very busy waterway.
William Yang is a senior analyst with Crisis Group based in Taipei. He says this is a massive example of Beijing's longtime maritime strategy.
The Chinese have always been utilizing what a lot of the analysts call maritime militia to achieve and help to advance their interest in the maritime domain along the first island chain. As we know, China has several disputes with neighboring countries in waters that go all the way from Japan down to the Philippines. And in recent years, the Chinese government and the Chinese Coast Guard have been relying more and more on diversifying the approach, trying to assert control over these disputed waters by relying on these thousands of Chinese fishing boats that will be deployed all at once and then practicing what we are seeing here, forming coordinated physical blocks that essentially will allow the Chinese government and also the Chinese Navy, Chinese Coast Guard to gain actual control of these very critical maritime nodes that are very important to China, but also regional and global trade as well.
So ultimately, are you saying the intent of the Chinese government in doing this is to basically expand territory?
Yes, because a lot of these disputed waters from the East China Sea all the way down to the Taiwan Strait and the South China Sea, from Beijing's perspective, are all viewed as their inner sea. And while they are trying to pursue some form of diplomatic settlement or the ongoing diplomatic tug of war between China and the other country, they are continuing to ramp up their capability to use coast guards and maritime militia to help to advance China's push. Essentially, it's an incremental push off the envelope in a way that as they try to establish new normals of the deployment of these large number of fishing vessels or maritime coast guard vessels, they will be able to essentially establish new normal, allow the Chinese to essentially be able to gain actual control of these waterways whenever they want to, because they now have the ability to deploy and summon thousands of ships all at once to essentially blockade and make sure they have the total control of these critical waterways.
You used the word militia to describe some of these vessels a moment ago. Some of these vessels are described as fishing boats. Are you saying that these are not legitimate fishing boats, or some of them anyway?
So a lot of these boats are what in the maritime sense would be called shadow fleets, where they are not really lawfully or legally registered in a very transparent way. A lot of these vessels might actually be conducting under more than one flag, and that actually, in fact, allowed them to be able to evade the radar system's detection. And sometimes a lot of these vessels would suddenly, in the middle of their operation, switch flags so that they will not be targeted or identified as potentially threatening. But if, in fact, a lot of these vessels are operated by Chinese nationals. So, you know, that is how the Chinese government has really intensified the use of these vessels for dual purposes.
What is kind of the thumbnail recent history of where China has done this before elsewhere?
So they have concentrated the deployment of these maritime militia at a large scale like this, focusing on the East China Sea and the South China Sea. These are two of the waterways that will be very crucial for Beijing to ensure that they can block off the sea lanes that can both prevent reinforcement coming in from potentially the U.S. deploying forces from the Philippines or Japan, but also at the same time forming a total blockade that can prevent energy sources and also other very important supplies going into Taiwan in a potential contingency so that they can essentially cut off Taiwan. And that's why I think experts and also analysts are very concerned about this new development that we're seeing in the East China Sea.
I'm speaking with William Yong in Taipei with the Crisis Group. So can these ships just hang out indefinitely in this part of the East China Sea with Japan's Navy doing really nothing about it?
I mean, I think because this phenomenon is still relatively new, and also the frequency of these phenomena has not really increased that much in the East China Sea. So I believe the Japanese authorities and the Taiwanese authorities were in fact caught off guard a little bit. As we know, these two formations in fact went largely unnoticed when they took place first in December and then January. And I think the countries in the region are still struggling to actually come up with a set of very established protocols to deal with the increasing threat that China is conducting through these maritime militia. Because if they overuse the forces that are against these maritime militia, which are essentially civilian vessels, then it could justify further escalation from the Chinese side or justify more aggressive actions that the Chinese can consider.
I'm curious, what do you think the placement of all these ships does in addition to any other threats that China has been carrying out in this part of the world? At sea.
In other parts of the world, sometimes China's maritime militia also are focusing on, say, overfishing in a particular location. That has, in fact, also posed serious challenges to ecological system in specific part of the oceans in, say, even as far as in Latin America. So we also cannot rule out the possibility that the Chinese government actually is trying to monopolize the certain maritime resources that might be very rich in this part of the East China Sea. But I think that's also a very high likelihood, as the competition for extracting very important materials like rare earth along the seabed is also increasingly becoming very contentious.
William, just as a provocation, how worried are you by these moves in the East China Sea by Beijing?
I think this should be viewed as an expected development or an evolution of the Chinese maritime strategy along the first island chain. Because I think since last year, we already sense the signal of China increasing their preparation for unification with Taiwan through many different means. And this also includes increasing the intensity of their gray zone operations along the first island chain. So it's in line of what China has already been doing, but the scale and also the nature of these two particular formations, I think, adds more evidence to the worries that the international community has already had over the last few years in terms of China's increasing ambition to prepare to make the potential move against Taiwan at some point in the future.
William Yong is a senior analyst with Crisis Group based in Taipei. So that was fishboat diplomacy in the East China Sea. Later this hour, we'll hear about gunboat diplomacy in the Persian Gulf. That story's ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A brutal murder in France has increased tensions between the country's political left and right. It happened Saturday in the city of Lyon. A group that has been described as far-left militants beat a far-right militant to death in a bloody street fight in broad daylight. Police have arrested several suspects, two of whom work for France's largest left-leaning political party. As The World's Jerry Haddon reports, the incident could have long-lasting effects, including on next year's presidential elections.
23-year-old math student and far-right militant Quentin Deronc tried to walk away after masked attackers beat him on a city sidewalk last weekend. He made it a few hundred feet, then collapsed. 2 days later, he died from his severe brain injuries. One young man saw the whole thing.
J'entends des cris et tout. Ça se frappait avec des barres en fer et tout, etc. Et tout.
I could hear all this screaming, the anonymous man tells French media outlet Le Parisien. They were beating him with iron bars. It was terrible. Should I have intervened, he asks out loud. It was really violent, he says. There were around 30 attackers, 11 of whom have already been arrested, according to the French police. Most of the attention, though, is focused on two of the suspects. Both are aides to this man, Raphaël Arnaud.
Le RN, pourtant le seul parti à être lié au moins trois affaires de terrorisme.
This was Arnaud last year, lashing out against France's far-right National Rally Party and its militants' track record of violence. The venue, France's parliament. Arnaud is an MP from the France Unbowed party. It's the country's most powerful left-leaning group. France Unbowed's leader, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, came in third in the last presidential elections. Before getting into politics, Arnaud gained fame as leader of an extreme-left anti-fascist group called the Young Guard. It was disbanded last year by the French government, accused of acts of violence.
C'est le rôle de l'antifascisme, c'est une réponse à l'extrême droite.
On a French talk show last month, Arnaud described the Young Guard as a necessary response to France's dozens of neo-fascist groups and their attacks on immigrants and other minorities. We only existed, he said, because the far right exists. Still, with two of Arnaud's aides in jail, things don't look good for his France Unbowed party. And the far right National Rally is trying to capitalize on that. On Sunday, thousands of far-right sympathizers gathered in the rain in Paris to pay tribute to the murdered Quentin. One young man took the mic and blamed France Unbowed. They threw him to the ground and left him for dead, he said. Quentin, he went on, is now a martyr and a legend. Political scientist Françoise Dreyfus, professor emeritus at Paris 1 University, says French society as a whole will not likely embrace Quentin as a martyr, but she says the far right's real goal, to turn France's left-wing parties, from the communists to the ecologists, against each other before 2027's presidential election.
The problem is that sometimes we join all the left, and now it will be impossible for the traditional left to join with the France Insoumise. That's impossible.
France Insoumise is the French for France Unbowed. French political parties often join together in coalition when they can't win on their own.
I think that all the leaders are just terrified by the idea that they can be associated with criminals, you know?
Dreyfus says political thuggery is nothing new in France, but it has historically come from the far right.
Always, when I was a student, a very long time ago, well, we had the right who were just biting us and so on. It was at the moment of the Algeria War.
That's going back to the 1950s. The far right's penchant for violence and racism is what's held it back politically. But in recent years, the National Rally has tried to clean up its image. Its young leader, Jordan Bardella, spoke yesterday in Paris at party headquarters.
Ce que nous avons vu ce week-end est un déchaînement de haine.
What happened this weekend was barbaric, unbridled hatred, he said. For years, France's far left has been slowly creating an atmosphere of violence. If that violent label, the same one that's held the far right back for decades, sticks to the leftist lapels, France could elect its first far right president next year. In the latest surveys, Jordan Bardella is already polling first. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
The big dance competition has concluded at Carnaval in Rio de Janeiro, bringing the eight-day party to an end, and now comes the aftermath. The celebration leading up to Lent involves some 2 million people descending on the city. The revelers are known to cover their costumes, their clothing, and themselves in glitter. And when it comes to cleanup, that is one big shiny mess. Juan Diego Rodriguez Blanco is an investigator at Trinity College Dublin. He told me it is also a major source of plastic pollution.
The base of glitter is a microplastic that we usually call polyethylene terephthalate, PET. Okay, this is the base, which is the main microplastic. And then above this main layer of plastics, they put layers of different dyes or different other organic compounds that produces the color. And what happens with these microplastics is that sooner or later, these microplastics will end up in wastewater, And that wastewater ends up in seawater. And it's very attractive for marine fauna. What I mean is that the fishes are going to be attracted by the colors, will eat that. Also, these plastics will tend to break in smaller pieces, and they are very, very difficult to control, and they are what we call newer contaminants.
You described really well the problem of glitter for marine life. One has to assume that glitter accumulates, though, year after year. It's not like they can clean up Carnival 2026 and they say the problem's done. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. The problem is that we are not dealing from glitter from 2025 or 2026. So we are dealing with glitter and other microplastics that have been in the oceans for years and years and years. And the problem is that they take plenty of time to degrade. And they break in very tiny plastics that we call nanoplastics. Nanoplastics are amazingly small plastic particles. And just to give you some numbers, one single glitter particle, it can break in about between 10 and 20 billion of nanoplastics.
That what? They end up one in. Piece of glitter?
Yeah, one single glitter particle, and that ends up everywhere.
So when people straight up rub this stuff on their bodies, then what happens?
I mean, the problem is that we don't know. I mean, scientifically speaking, we know that it's not very good to have a diet that contains microplastics, no? But what happens if those microplastics end up in our bloodstreams? I mean, there is research indicating that this potentially could produce heart attacks, for example. Okay, this kind of research, it is in its infancy. We need to do a lot of research on microplastics and the effects in our bodies, in other living creatures, in the oceans, in the carbon cycle, everywhere.
Juan Diego, I'm worried that you're going to tell us we have to cancel glitter, but is there an alternative?
In theory, there is an alternative. I mean, there is something that we call eco-friendly glitter. And this is glitter that is made of specially modified cellulose, which is coming from hardwoods of eucalyptus, for example. But the problem is not that. The problem is that we already have disposed too much rubbish, too much plastic rubbish in the oceans. So this eco-friendly glitter obviously is very nicely welcome. But the problem is, what have we been doing during the last 50 years?
And so what efforts have been underway to encourage the use of those alternatives?
I mean, the first thing is to try to ban microplastics or glitter. But glitter is not only used in parties or in carnivals. I mean, it is used also for fashion. It is used also for fishing. The military are using glitter in ways that we don't know, okay? Mm. It's used in boats, not in ships, no? So it's not so simple, you know what I mean?
Well, other countries have actually banned plastic glitter and have seen a lot of growth in biodegradable glitter products. The EU apparently has banned glitter in cosmetics. So I'm wondering, why haven't these moves taken hold in Brazil?
The problem with this is that one thing is to ban the product, but another thing is this ban is not going to be immediate. It's also a matter of money. What I mean is that it may be cheaper and easier to produce glitter made of plastic compared to eco-friendly glitter. So it's not something that is going to happen in 24 hours. This is going to take years.
Yeah. I mean, let's face it, glitter is a lot of fun, clearly a central part of Carnival in Rio. What is your message to people about how to keep sparkling and staying fabulous, but also just being more environmentally friendly?
Well, the message is very simple. If you're using glitter, this is something that you can have fun with, but at the end, it's going to end up in our bodies because marine life is going to eat that. And sooner or later, I mean, this is a cycle. We are eating our own rubbish. I'm sorry to say that clearly, no, but this is ended up in our bodies, and we need more research on this. Otherwise, we are not going to know the consequences of disposing so much glitter and microplastics in the ocean.
Juan Diego Rodriguez Blanco is an investigator at Trinity College Dublin. While the world is watching this year's Winter Games, many other Olympic hopefuls are competing in a wider range of less chilly sports, shall we say, some of which will be new to the 2028 Games in Los Angeles, like flag football. Believe it or not, some 20 million people worldwide play flag football. Earlier this month, San Francisco held an international event. Azul Dahlstrom Ekman at KQED reports.
At Moscone Center, kids from Team Panama and Team Japan are duking it out in this year's NFL Flag International Championships. The teams are co-ed, and all the athletes are under 13. This finals match caps a tournament of teams from 14 different countries. The kids play a variation of football where instead of tackling each other, they need to strip a length of fabric dangling from either side of their opponent's waist.
It's really unique. Like, I feel like it's not really like any other games. Like, you're getting tagged at hips, you know, and you have to like move your hips. So yeah, it's unique, but it's really good.
Beth Spicer plays on the team representing Ireland. She says she only learned how to throw a football a few months ago, but she's fallen in love.
I'd really like to like play it as like a sport. I think it'd be really cool.
Rob Cooper, the Irish team's head coach, says the NFL reached out to their school last year, asking if they'd be interested in free training and equipment. He says while soccer is one of the biggest sports back home, flag football has a lot of potential.
It's been an amazing experience, and I've no doubt that flag football, especially in Ireland, where we're coming from, will continue to grow and grow massively over the next couple of years.
The NFL says that flag football is one of the fastest growing sports in the world, with 20 million players worldwide. Afia Law heads up international flag football development for the NFL.
I mean, I think for us internationally, it's all about creating access to the game for people.
She says the league started its first international flag football program in Mexico in 2000, but has ramped up efforts in recent years, especially in countries like Australia, Spain, and Brazil, where the NFL is growing its reach. Flag football is also set to debut at the 2028 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles. It doesn't require helmets or pads. The games are shorter, faster paced, and there's only 5 players on the field for each team.
Third down and 12 yards from midfield.
29-year-old Cody Fuller is one of those Olympic hopefuls. She grew up playing tackle football, but transitioned to flag.
As I got a little bit older, the not taking hits every weekend definitely felt a lot nicer on the body.
She says flag's Olympic debut will create even more ways for young athletes, especially young women, to get into the sport.
And now we've got so many awesome pathways for these young girls and boys to kind of strive towards. We can sell the Olympic dream to all of them because it is a very real possibility now.
Here in the U.S., the NFL has committed $32 million to establish its own professional flag football league in the coming years. For The World, I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, San Francisco.
Earlier in the show, we heard about the tensions in the East China Sea with Chinese fishing boats. There is another theater of explicit brinksmanship at the moment, the Persian Gulf, where a conflict between Iran and the U.S. may be closer than ever. The U.S. has sent a large fleet of vessels and other military hardware to the region. While both sides have ratcheted up threats in the past 24 hours, officially, negotiations continue. The World's Shirin Jafari reports on America's most recent example of gunboat diplomacy.
Jets fly over the USS Abraham Lincoln carrier. Several other ships are visible in the background. These ships and jets are within striking distance of Iran. This is gunboat diplomacy in action. Andrew Leatham teaches international relations at McAllister College in Minnesota. This is how he defines the term.
The deployment of naval assets short of a full all-out war to gain concessions from a country.
Military muscle has been part of the Trump administration's foreign policy. The U.S. used the same tactic in the lead-up to the capture of Venezuela's leader last month. It's a tactic that the country has used in the past, Latham explains. For example, as far back as the 19th century case involving the U.S. and Japan.
One classic case of Commodore Perry, an American naval officer leading the so-called black ships into Tokyo Harbor, to force the Japanese government to open up economic connections between Japan and the United States. The Japanese were resisting that, and Commodore Perry sailed his ships into Tokyo Harbor and said, sign the treaty or else, and the Treaty of Kanawaga was signed as a result of that.
There are other examples, he says. Gunboat diplomacy is typically carried out by countries with powerful militaries, and because of this imbalance of power, it's historically been successful. Right now, the largest aircraft carrier in the world, USS Gerald Ford, is also on its way to join the Abraham Lincoln carrier in the area. Retired Vice Admiral Kevin Donegan commanded a carrier strike group. Speaking at a session at the Middle East Institute yesterday, he said the commanders of these ships are getting ready.
They're well ahead of this, right? And they're starting to, in their minds, work through courses of actions that they could present where the military arm could be useful to civilian leadership in the Pentagon.
These military buildups are expensive and complex operations, says Michael Eisenstadt. He directs the military and security studies at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
But it's something that we, something the United States specializes in, because we are a expeditionary military. We fight overseas.
Iranian leaders have said they do not give concessions under pressure. Eisenstadt says that's not necessarily true.
But the fact of the matter is they do. The JCPOA was, the nuclear deal in 2015, was a result of a pressure campaign by the United States. And likewise, you know, everybody said that if the United States attacks Iran last summer, there won't be a diplomatic process afterwards. The Iranians will not meet with the U.S. And so not only are they, previously they only met through intermediaries, now they're meeting face to face.
But gunboat diplomacy is always used with a lot of caution and control, says Latham of McAllister College. One wrong move could start an all-out war. When a leader commits to this method and deploys so many resources, he says, it becomes irreversible.
If Donald Trump, President Trump, doesn't get what he wants, it's hard for him to say, oops, we made a mistake, bring the carriers home. Because then nobody else will believe your threats in the future, right?
Today, nearly 50 representatives of the Board of Peace met in Washington, D.C. This is a group Trump has assembled to oversee his ceasefire plan in Gaza. Trump was vague on the likelihood of a military strike on Iran. He told the audience that they will find out in the next 10 days. He went on to add that Iran must agree to a deal, otherwise bad things will happen. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
If you could use a long walk right about now, you're not alone. Up next, we'll hear from a man who's been walking for 13 years. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. We have been regularly checking in with National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek for a couple of years now. Paul is on a 21,000-mile journey across the globe, almost entirely on foot. His project is the Out of Eden Walk, and he's been on the road now for a total of 13 years. So today we're marking that milestone in our conversation. And Paul, that means this project of yours is officially a teenager. How does that feel?
Well, it's as rambunctious and chaotic as a teenager would be. So I'm just writing it out, Marco.
Can you take us back to the beginning? Because I don't think we've ever spoken about the origin story of this project. How did the Out of Eden Walk start before you even took those first steps in Ethiopia?
Well, I had been an international correspondent working mainly for the Chicago Tribune for many years, based for almost a decade out of Africa. And as a print began to implode, I decided to try to do something new, which was to kind of get off the high-speed lifestyle of being a foreign correspondent, often a war correspondent, and to slow myself down. And so back in 2013, as you mentioned, the anniversary just last month, I set out walking from Ethiopia, the Rift Valley of Africa, and the idea was to use deep history as a mirror to reflect on unfolding current events and to do something I call slow journalism, which is to kind of walk through the big headlines of our day at 5 kilometers an hour. That's how it all started.
You said you were a foreign correspondent. You wanted to slow down. But what did your life look like before the walk started?
Well, you know, it was I was based in Johannesburg, and I was the one-man band along with a South African colleague who was an administration office manager of the Africa, the Sub-Saharan Africa Bureau. So I had this ridiculous beat of covering more than 40 countries. And I was basically living kind of like a fireman for a little while. If there's a war in the Congo, or that war was going on for years, an election in Kenya, if there was some kind of desertification issue going on in the Sahel, environmental stories, you name it, I would jump on a plane and go cover these stories. And I had great editors. They let me sink my teeth in. I could spend sometimes weeks and on occasion even months on a topic that was important enough to the African communities that I had the privilege of covering. So in a sense, Marco, what I try to remind my readers that, you know, kind of letting it all go and kind of putting on my walking shoes and walking the earth was not a midlife crisis. I mean, I was 50 when I started. It was just a continuation of a methodology and a refinement, maybe even better word, of a methodology, deep dives grassroots reporting, passing the baton, passing the microphone, that a procedure that I've already been doing for years.
I'm wondering how you pictured the walk. Just how did it play out in your head before you got started, or maybe in those first footsteps?
You know, that's really a good question, because I sort of couldn't. I mean, who kind of comes up with a concept to go walk the earth? And I certainly didn't have too many preconceived notions. I was just going to go with the flow. And what I told my colleagues at National Geographic, my editors for whom I'm writing, is that I'm going to do this kind of seat of the pants, just looking not at the destination, right? It's really day to day. So one of the things that the walk has done personally for me is really put me in the moment and kind of encouraged me, of course, to plan. I mean, planning is essential. You'd be foolish not to, but also to know when to relinquish plans and to be comfortable with pivoting, with sidestepping, even with stepping back, because our ancestors did this as they were walking out of Africa.
Paul, you spoke earlier of your trek as the journey of humankind, but it's also a trek through the physical planet. You know, the writer John McPhee, in his great book about North American geology, Basin and Range, he equates the billions of years of Earth history in a number of analogies that geologists love to use. One of them, which always blew my mind, being the distance from your nose to the tip of your outstretched hand. Imagine that's 5 billion years. And in this scale, one stroke of a nail file on the middle finger erases all human history. I bring that up because I wonder how you've been feeling the grand scale of time on Earth as you move slowly across the planet.
Two answers, one kind of an intellectual answer and then a more emotional one. On the intellectual level, I use a similar idea when I talk to readers about, you know, how strange is it to go out walking continents, right? That, you know, many, especially students I talk to schools, say, God, what you're doing is really kind of lunatic. It's kind of extreme. Isn't it dangerous? Isn't it unusual? And I have to try to remind them that we have been doing this. We, Homo sapiens, have been nomadic, have been ramblers, right? For the vast majority of our time frame on the planet, we've been moving freely across landscapes that change every day. And so it's natural. What I tell my readers is what I'm doing is actually harkening back to our norm. And what you generally are doing, you know, when I'm talking to you is, you know, you're probably sitting down somewhere. That's kind of unnatural. The second thing is, like, how do I look at time emotionally? I don't know if I've spoken about this before, but imagine, Marco, waking up in my shoes to a brand new horizon every single morning of your life. What does that do to you? I mean, it could paralyze you with fear. It could inspire you. Often it does both, but you have to do something. So all you do is take one unmitigated step, another unremediated step, and you just, that's it. That's the way you make progress, knowing that many of these steps are going to be blind.
Just those words motivates me to basically walk away from the microphone right now and start walking somewhere, but I need to finish this interview, Paul.
Okay.
And I want to ask you this. Walking 13 years, that's a long time. It's not 5 billion years, but that's a long time on foot. In many ways, I'm not the same person I was 13 years ago, and I'm not just talking about my gray hair. How has your walk changed you?
You know, that's a really good question. It's a natural question. But, you know, remember that I was 50 when I started this project. So, you know, I was pretty much my ideas, my the way I moved through the world, which was also semi-nomadic even back then. I wasn't like a standard conventional foreign correspondent. So on the one hand, I can't say that like I'm a totally different person. On the other, I think the walk has taught me certain things about my personality that have kind of smoothed out maybe a few wrinkles. I can be very, you know, type A, very competitive, very kind of task orientated. And I think the walk kind of has been teaching me for years to be more patient with myself and therefore with others. I think it's made me a calmer person.
So finally, Paul, the future. Do you have any insights from the past 13 years? And maybe they offer some clues about your vision for the road ahead.
This is one of the things we're talking about, this notion of this geography of chance. When I took a ship, a container ship from Japan, you know, Eurasia, you know, I was thinking that, you know, the Americas going to be a snap. The Americas, I mean, right? The continent. I would be, you know, not so much kind of dealing with security issues, right? With political turmoil. And look at the panorama ahead. So there it is. Another lesson that you can't really plan too much ahead. It's good to plan, but be ready to give up a plan. Be ready to pivot. And so the 3 years ahead will be something novel that I had no conception of when I set out in 2013.
That is National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek. Paul, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Likewise, Marco.
You can read all of Paul's dispatches and see incredible photos from throughout his 13 years of walking online. It's all at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. Our original reporting is also on YouTube. I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Piggott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.